That wasn't the Redfern case.
It might have been the Redfern case. And the injury to the back was of little significance. That was cured. But there was a psychological effect that followed that trauma, a physical trauma. And the court had no difficulty finding compensability. There was another case in which workers, female workers in a factory, were overcome, and it was an hysterical amnesia, an hysterical something or other. It resulted from their smelling fumes from a damaged piece of equipment. The fumes themselves didn't cause the collapse, the fainting. It was simply a response, an hysterical response to the fumes which they believed were harmful. And the court didn't find it difficult to provide compensation. There were any number of similar cases, and I referred to them and explained them and built upon those cases and finally reached the Carter case, in which there wasn't a single event. There was instead a whole series of events, day after day after day, the constant repetitive experiences of a production line worker ultimately had an emotional effect. And in his case, and this was very significant, the only psychological testimony in the case came from the plaintiff. There was absolutely no effort made to counter that testimony by General Motors. General Motors offered no expert at all, attempted only to undermine the credibility of the plaintiff's expert by cross-examination, and failed. Now, our task as an appellate court was to determine whether the board, the appeal board, had sufficient evidence in the record to support its ruling. And it did, no question about it. And I reached that conclusion quickly, no problem at all. I spent most of my time in the opinion trying to explain why this wasn't such a dramatic change from the past, that it was a logical extension of the law of compensability of emotional injury. And the case elicited enormous outrage from defense lawyers and from the medical profession and from the manufacturing industry. I had a telephone call. I had a letter first from a very close friend of mine who was a doctor. He wanted to know why, as close as we were, I hadn't consulted with him about the medical significance of the decision. My response to him was, my friend, you know, if I had been willing to consult with you, I'd have been willing to consult with others about other cases as well as this one, and that isn't what judges of a court are supposed to do. He ultimately came around and understood what I said.
Well, as I recall, and I, again, don't want to make a claim to expertise here, but that it was a very cogent, as you say, that developed the issue in a succession almost precedent, whatever you call it.
My objective was to develop the background of my ruling, my holding, in such a way that it would demonstrate that the common law, and we're really talking about common law, even though we're applying the workers' compensation statute, works in incremental fashion, sometimes you can move the law one full step at a time. Here you are at this point, and the next decision will carry you to this point. But more often than not, what happens is you take half a step instead of a full step in developing a legal concept. And that's what happened in this case, in the Carter case. We were really taking only a half step, not the giant step that our critics portrayed us as taking. It was just a half step removed from those cases in which there was a single traumatic event. In this case, there were a series of traumatic events.
How would you describe your writings on the subject of governmental immunity? I think Dwight Shaw said that Parker was the first of a succession.
I wrote a lot of cases on
governmental immunity. And finally, the law just left the idea of governmental immunity just sort of broke down across the country.
Now, my memory of it, Roger, was that by 1968, when I left the court, the court had begun to articulate a relatively simple principle that would be universally applicable to governmental and charitable immunity cases. And it related really to the notion that there shouldn't be immunity, judge-made immunity at least, for any such institution. That if there were to be immunity, it ought to be granted by the legislature that has the capacity to consider policy issues that courts rarely are equipped to consider, and even more rarely to decide. Because the legislative policies in most cases. And in 68, as I recall it, the issue was one of retroactivity. To what extent should our current rulings abrogating the immunity of the sovereign apply retroactively to cases that are pending at the time of the decision? I gather, though I haven't gotten involved in it since I left the court, that the issue became far more complex in the few years that followed my departure, and ultimately the legislature got involved, and I don't know where governmental immunity is today.